Welcome to Episode 4 of Rise, an Eastern Standard six-part series inspired by the extreme flash flood of last summer that claimed 44 lives and swept away more than 1,000 homes, severely damaging hundreds more. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. During a recent press conference in Hazard, Governor Andy Beshear took us back to July 28, 2022.
What you've gone through is something that nobody, no county, should ever have to endure. No region should ever have to see. I mean, the loss of so many people, and then thousands of our fellow Kentuckians, our neighbors, our friends, people we go to church with and work with, just losing everything. And I don't think most people truly understand when we say losing everything. It means that those that we were pulling up into helicopters literally only had the clothes on their back, and we're thankful just to be alive.
In this episode, how the experience of such a terrible event and the difficulties that followed and continue to be felt, as well as the kindness of neighbors and strangers, how these things influence the mental well-being of people and communities.
There's all of this need, and there's empty houses all over the place. There's encampments and temporary housing and buyouts. That can't help but have an effect.
The Mountain Association's Jimmy Owsley is a member of the Floyd County Long-Term Recovery Group.
One of my fellow group members said it well when she said a lot of recoveries are a two-year effort, and this one looks like a five-year effort.
In this episode 4 of Rise, we're looking at the ways the experience of the tragic flash flood of last July, six-inch deep creeks ballooning to depths of up to 30 feet in just hours, the powerful flow sweeping away everything in its path, how living through that, or losing somebody to it, or both, and people so rooted in place getting used to a new home, new neighbors, new ways of doing things, how all of that affects the spirits and the mental and emotional well-being of survivors.
They're just so overwhelmed and frustrated.
Applered disaster resource attorney Whitney Bailey.
The ones who've lost their husbands or other loved ones, that those are especially difficult to have those initial meetings with. And, you know, I try to make sure I ask at some point, how is your mental health? Because yes, we have to work through these other issues, but are you also taking care of yourself? Because you can't fill anybody else's cup if yours is empty.
The stress is felt among mental health care caseworkers themselves, such as Jamie Mullen Smith at Kentucky River Community Care, who, like so many in Breathitt County, thought surely the flood of 2021 was the last they would see of this kind of thing, for a while at least.
The Breathitt County Long-Term Recovery Team closed their last case in June 2021, and we had a conversation about continuing that group and moving more toward planning and preparedness. And so we agreed that we would take July off and we would start back after school started in August. And unfortunately, the end of July, we were hit with what we have been told was the 1,000-year flood.
Mullen Smith grew up in River Caney, one of the hardest hit communities.
Yes, it's definitely been a hard hit, especially in Breathitt County. But I remind people that progress is progress, whether that's an inch or a mile. And whether that's you or your neighbor, as long as we can look for beacons of hope and light and we can focus on them, we are moving forward.
There are so many stressful circumstances to overcome. Overnight, almost in an instant, many were left homeless. And now, 6 months later, are still living in travel trailers rolled into the region to provide temporary housing. The bills, including mortgage payments, keep piling up, leaving people with many spinning plates day to day. Corinne Boyer has Elizabeth Miller's story.
Imagine your home has been flooded. After the waters recede, maybe the first thing you do is muck out your house. Or maybe it's finding a construction crew or a volunteer group to help repair it. But what would you do if your house washed away?
I had just purchased a new double wide. It was 2 years old. And when the flood came, I mean, it took it like it wasn't nothing. It took everything we had, everything.
That's what happened to Elizabeth Miller. The flood swept away her home and everything in it. She's a single mom of two and lives in Perry County. After she lost her home in late July, Miller lived in her car for a week. Then she stayed in a friend's small camper. Finally, at the end of September, Miller used FEMA aid and took out a loan from a friend to buy another home.
I had to go with a single wife. We couldn't get back what we had, but we did get another home, thank God. Grateful for that.
But there's more to Miller's story. In addition to borrowing money from a friend, she maxed out her credit cards to replace all the furniture, clothing, and everything else taken by the flood. More surprisingly, though, Miller is stuck with mortgage payments from the home she lost.
I still owe $82,000 on the home I had, and they still want me to pay for it. And I've been having trouble with that.
Miller is on the verge of declaring bankruptcy because she cannot afford two mortgages. Before the flood,
I was doing great. My credit score was almost up to 800. I was able to, you know, whatever my kids wanted, whatever, we just done really well. And finally had my own home that I did. You know, I mean, that was an accomplishment to me that I did that by myself.
Miller had a loan with Vanderbilt Mortgage and Finance, a Berkshire Hathaway company. She says Vanderbilt told her to repair her home. So Miller sent the company a video.
I had a video of the house actually just washing away, and I sent that to him. I said, it's gone. There's nothing to repair. You know, there's nothing left.
Vanderbilt Mortgage and Finance declined to be interviewed for this story or to answer specific questions about how they help homeowners hit by disasters. Instead, they sent a short statement saying they work with homeowners facing hardships and offer loan modifications, payment extensions, or a homeowners assistance program. They did not provide details about how these programs work. When Miller asked Vanderbilt if they had any kind of loan forgiveness programs, the company told her,
"No. I didn't do anything like that."
In Kentucky, the Public Protection Cabinet Department of Financial Institutions investigates complaints about lenders. The Public Protection Cabinet also declined to be interviewed for this story. In an email, a spokesperson said individuals can contact the agency with questions about their specific case. Many flood survivors still face huge financial barriers. This also takes a toll on survivors' mental health. That's something Whitney Bailey, a lawyer at the legal aid nonprofit Apple Red, sees frequently.
In almost every single initial meeting, I've had probably the majority of my clients just sit down, tell me their stories, and we just cry together. Yeah, they're just so overwhelmed and frustrated.
Although Bailey could not specifically comment on Miller's case, Bailey explained that a common clause allows for contracts to be canceled when a disaster hits.
I'm going to say in most contracts, especially mortgage contracts, there will be a force majeure clause, the whole acts of God. This flood was outside of anybody's control.
Bailey says people like Miller should have other options.
Her experience is traumatic and a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and she should not have to pay.
6 months have passed since the July flood. Bailey is frustrated by struggles her clients still face. People need space heaters and winter coats. And one person continues to wait for replacement dentures.
FEMA asked him, he was like, "Well, were your dentures medically necessary?" And he is like, "Well, you know, sometimes I like to eat peanuts and not just peanut butter." And he tried to be a good sport about it, but he still doesn't have his dentures. And he is extremely limited on the foods he's able to consume right now.
During a follow-up call with Miller, she says she's doing a little better. But she says Vanderbilt, her mortgage company, has taken additional steps against her.
They have already sent in against my credit as a charge-off and turned it over to their collection agency.
Miller says she's looking into other options, but feels like her only choice may be to file for bankruptcy. For Eastern Standard on WEKU, I'm Corinne Boyer.
In the days and weeks following the flood last July, something was happening among children in the region.
Basically, their most immediate needs I see is mental health. We have children, they have come into that school and it's been raining. They're everyone crying. And I mean, I'm not talking one or two, I'm talking 59, 60. We lost a ton of kids.
Genevieve Neese is the Family Resource Center Coordinator at Sebastian Middle School in Jackson.
We have so many that are petrified of storms now and rain, dark clouds. Honey, they want to go under the desk. They're so scared sometimes.
When it's raining or thundering and lightning out, that brings them back to the time, the original thing, and brings about that emotional response and that sensory response that they had going through the initial flood.
Dr. Joe Bargione, a certified school psychologist and Kentucky Youth Advocate's resident expert on adverse childhood experiences.
Let them know that it's okay to have those experience, those feelings that they have. But also what we want to try and do in that situation at school is empowering those children to let them know that there are adults there who care for them, who will watch them and take care of them.
Jamie Mullen-Smith of Kentucky River Community Care.
My mom and dad had neighbors that, like, seven little kids under the age of 10. And you know, when it rains, they are having a harder and difficult time and maybe going to school. They're having attachment issues. There's some regression and maybe potty training. So that is definitely something that we are seeing. There is an increase in asking for children's services, maybe like school-based therapy. And that is available in all the schools in our region. And if anybody does not know how to get that, they can contact us, and we will link them to those services.
Teresa Botts is a psychology professor at Eastern Kentucky University. She concentrates on trauma, grief, depression, and anxiety disorders.
Some kids might act out. Some may cry. Some may show regressive behaviors, increase separation anxiety, be more clingy to their parents, caregivers, teachers. They may start to develop baby talk that has been absent for many, many years. Bedwetting is another one. With older kids, we see stress manifested sometimes in aggression towards their siblings. They might have trouble in school. They may show sleep disturbances.
Dr. Bott says this reaction to rainfall among flood survivors is not limited to children.
Rainfall definitely falls in one of those categories in terms of being activating. So that when we have storms and we have heavy rainfall, or even light rainfall, people are impacted and they may develop some of the PTSD symptoms in terms of more intensity.
What sorts of symptoms?
Many of them are experiencing long-term psychosocial effects, such as stress reactions, depression. We see increased substance use, anxiety, interpersonal dysfunction. We talk a lot about emotional dysregulation and doing therapy work, and I think we're definitely seeing that. We've got increased somatic symptoms, some suicidality, and probably one of the main things that we commonly see is development of post-traumatic stress disorder.
At the Apple Red office in Prestonsburg, reporter Corinne Boyer found attorney Whitney Bailey absorbing the stress.
Trying to deal with the emotional side and taking that home, because these flood survivors stay on my mind because this is their life. I get to go home and kind of detach a little bit, but this is their life. So I'm struggling with that personally.
Struggling with the terrible circumstances that she hears from the people sitting across her desk.
Her son was staying at a friend's house that night, and it was on a school night too, or whatever the situation was out of the norm. And she ended up breaking both of her legs and back and losing her husband and mother-in-law. They ended up drowning in the flood. And she was just so thankful that her son wasn't there that night to have to experience that through them, or with them, I mean. But clients like that, and then I have another client in Letcher County who I think he was 6 or 7 year old son was the one that woke up randomly at 2 a.m. and said, "Mom, there's water in the house." And, you know, she put her feet on the floor and the carpet was already wet. And they were like, "Oh, crap, we gotta get out." And the son told her later, you know, "It's my fault. I should have been awake sooner to get us out of the house and to save more of our things and to help evacuate." So these kids are definitely taking on this emotional burden and kind of blaming themselves somehow. But that mom has done a really great job of working through those feelings with him and empowering him to talk to his guidance counselor.
If you're a flood survivor and you're feeling like your bandwidth is stretched to the limit, you're at capacity, you're feeling overwhelmed, but you don't know where or who to turn to for help,
we have a crisis line at Kentucky River Community Care.
Jamie Mullen Smith.
That's 1-800-262-7491. Any kind of psychological distress they may be having, anxiety, fear, hopelessness, and they just need someone to talk to. There's trained people on the other end of that line that are from their communities that will understand what they're saying, and it will be a culturally competent communication and conversation.
That number again.
1-800-262-7491.
Seeking help from a mental health professional can be a touchy subject for many in Eastern Kentucky. Beattyville native Jody Treadway teaches Appalachian cultural psychology at Eastern Kentucky University.
It's hard enough to go to someone you know for assistance and put that burden on them and make that vulnerability or that inequality known. But to bring someone else into your personal business, we've got the small town busy body gossip everything, but also there's a live and let live sort of undercurrent.
So for many who might benefit from getting help, it just hasn't been an option. Kentucky River Community Care's Jamie Smith.
The stigma of seeking mental health services in Eastern Kentucky across the board is very high. People are very reluctant to seek those services. And I'll be honest, I don't know that they are aware that that may be some of the issues they're having. Like if they're having stomach issues or headaches, that could easily be linked to anxiety or feeling hopeless. And I don't know that they can link that themselves.
So there's a pretty powerful cultural resistance to seeking out mental health care.
You are right. That is a large stigma still in Eastern Kentucky as a whole. And that's what we want to do, is to educate individuals that and reduce that stigma to seeking services. We all have a certain amount that we can carry before we start to kind of get a weak knee. And we want our survivors to know that we are here to take some of that load off.
Do you see some people, maybe more than usual, resorting to self-medicating, to alcohol or to drugs?
Well, I think that was a trend that was already in place with COVID. Once we've seen some of our data, we know that the substance use had raised across the board during COVID. I think that we will see an increase in that, but if we do our job and teach them some healthy coping mechanisms and we link them to resources, that maybe we can curb some of that.
Are there ways to prepare ourselves to steel our minds for these kinds of natural disasters?
Well, you know, I do believe in personal preparedness. And a community preparedness, a county preparedness, a state preparedness. If we want to be both mentally and physically ready for a disaster, there's certain things that we need to have in our home at all times. You need a disaster preparedness plan for your family, whether that be fire, natural disaster, like a house fire or a natural disaster. There's certain things that you need, like enough water and non-perishable food to carry you through. What we saw in some of our communities after this latest flood, that it took up to 3 to 5 days before we could reach people. In my community, we were isolated for 3 days, but we could get to each other, and we were really lucky. We had a church that was willing to open their doors. We had people in the community that was willing to give people shelter and dry clothes, extra food. Every community, I would urge to have that conversation. Have a certain amount of personal preparedness, but it doesn't matter how prepared you are if you are impacted. But if everybody, if all your neighbors have a certain amount of preparedness, they have a certain amount of food and water and a plan, they can rely on each other. And that's kind of what we saw in our community. And we were able to get that done quickly because you had a couple of individuals like myself and the crisis coordinator for CARE-CC actually lives close to me. And we were able to pull those things together because that's what we do every day. But for the communities that doesn't have that within themselves, we would love to continue to have this conversation with churches and town hall meetings and community meetings where we say, you know, we go through the FEMA checklist or Red Cross checklist. Those are all online. And we have a personal preparedness on our own, not just for ourselves, but for our pets and our community. And when we are impacted, if you're lucky, maybe you'll have some people, even in the hardest hit neighborhoods, there were some homes that weren't impacted that opened their doors so that our survivors could seek shelter within those neighborhoods while they were isolated. And that's where your resilience comes in. That's where your community support comes in. So moving forward, CRAD is working on a regional disaster plan. Of course, each county has one. But what we know now after this last flood, when we had 7 of our 8 counties greatly impacted, 4 of which were major disasters, we leaned on our neighbors in our neighboring counties, and they came to us. They came to us in groves as soon, whether that was by ATVs or Jeeps, side-by-sides. I was so humbled by how quick people came to help from so far away.
So how to make that potentially life-altering connection and get some help with processing what's happened?
What we know about our survivors is if we are willing to meet them where they are more apt to have a conversation with us as opposed to pulling them out of what, you know, they're trying to recover from, bring them to a doctor's office in a sterile environment where they may not have the nicest clothes because they're still recovering, or their shoes may be muddy and they don't want to track up a waiting room. So they're more comfortable where they are in their communities. And we will go to them. Whatever services they need, we can do linkage and wrap around to them. If they need somebody to come out and actually see them and do a treatment plan, we'll do that too. We want to meet our survivors where they are.
This blend of frustration, confusion, and uncertainty is 6 months after the flood still being felt by many. And now, the displaced wait as the state works with the owners of land high above the floodplains to establish new communities.
I'm thrilled to announce a second location for building in Eastern Kentucky, this time on high ground right here in Hazard, Kentucky.
Governor Beshear held that press conference in Hazard in late January to announce that the Eisen family had donated a reclaimed mine site just outside of town for a place to build new homes for people who lost theirs to the flood. It's the second tract of land donated to create new neighborhoods for flood survivors. The other, in Knott County, was contributed by Sean and Tammy Adams of Georgetown.
Rebuilding on high ground is a chance to lift up communities, to make sure those that are willing to move there never have to go through what we have seen, to build safe, affordable, energy-efficient homes, to do the infrastructure in a way that solves decades of challenges and allows for more growth and more resiliency, even in our existing infrastructure with future flooding.
Relocation is in the cards for many. It won't be easy. In Eastern Kentucky, place means so much.
For the most part, Appalachians tend to stay close to home. And so in that sense, the community gets a lot more attached to the place.
Jody Treadway, the EKU professor who studies and teaches the cultural psychology of Appalachia.
Someone back in the 1800s, early 1900s, bought a huge tract of land fairly cheap, put a coal mine on it, put a small farm on it, did something with it. And as they had kids, they break that land up into smaller pieces. And so you get generations of children, descendants, people who marry in, sometimes friends of the family. We all know fictive kin is very important in Appalachia. But you get this whole creek bed, this whole ridge line that is kind of centered around one or two families. And then, as I said, the name gets attached, and that becomes Breeding Creek. That becomes Shoemaker Ridge. That's the name of this place.
As this relocation effort unfolds, it may be important to learn from the past. Mimi Pickering directed the documentary The Buffalo Creek Flood, An Act of Man and Buffalo Creek Revisited. It's about the flood that happened in Logan County, West Virginia, in February of 1972, when a coal slurry impoundment dam burst, flooding 16 coal communities. 125 people died, more than 1,100 were injured, and homes were swept away.
Buffalo Creek, as you said, had 16, coal mining communities. They were coal camps originally, and each had their own name and their own community. And, most people had bought the houses that the coal company had originally built. And, they were close communities. And they were, strung along the creek where the flat land was. And so I think a lot of that is really similar to, what we've got here in Letcher County and some of the other counties. Some of the hardest hit communities here are former coal camps, places like Burdon and Millstone and Seco and Thornton. And they were built close to the river and built by coal companies. And also, most importantly, I think, the people who lived there have been there for a long, long time, many of them. Many of those communities included extended families or people who, had lived near each other for many years. So, again, we're dealing with really tight communities that are dependent in a good way on each other, and they've just been, ripped apart. And so that was... And a huge part of the kind of the problems and the issues that arose from Buffalo Creek, and in addition, to the huge loss of life.
What are the parallels between Buffalo Creek and Eastern Kentucky?
Similar to Eastern Kentucky in some ways, there in West Virginia, there was just very little flat land that housing could be put on, and much of the land was owned by coal and timber companies, and those companies did not open any of that up for people. So, the government did create these trailer parks, basically, and most of them were not right on Buffalo Creek, because the other thing is the state decided they would build a highway through there, and so that prevented people from coming back to their homes. But the trailer parks were, people were just assigned to them, I guess, on, the kind of in the order that you got on the list and the number of people in your family. So they had these kind of concentrated, as one woman in the film says, calls them a concentration camp. But it just threw together people who really didn't know each other and had not lived together. And, there's a need, obviously, to quickly get people into shelter. And I think, they've done that with the travel trailers here and all, but the Buffalo Creek people ended up staying in those trailers for like years, so they couldn't go home. That became home, but it wasn't home. And I think that some of the psychological impacts of that were really severe, and that, it has been studied by different medical professionals. I did some film work in rural Louisiana after Katrina and Rita hurricanes, and it seemed like that, FEMA was doing the same thing they'd done in Buffalo Creek and just putting people into, randomly into these trailer camps that they set up. So the information is out there. The data is out there. The studies are out there that say, that's not a good way to go about it, but I'm not sure that, it's trickling down to those that do the setting up and the planning.
Documentary maker Mimi Pickering. By the way, the humanities faculty at Hazard Community and Technical College is hosting a screening of her documentary about Buffalo Creek, 5:30 to 8 p.m. on February 22nd. Pickering will be there for a discussion after the screening, and it's open to the public. A lot is being asked of the people of these counties that have been hit so hard. The likelihood of more extreme weather is leaving those who have lived creek and riverside for generations no choice but to make new homes on higher ground if they can hold on and remain in the region for as long as it will take to get them built. In the meantime, there is the unsettling loss of something that defines life in the mountains and the hollers of southeastern Kentucky, its communities, settlements that bear the names and, in many cases, the graves of ancestors. Dr. Treadway.
From what I understand of the plans, it's not just land. This is going to come with built houses and subdivisions and plans for goods and services and a school and senior citizen centers and retirement villages. It's going to become a whole planned community. The thing is, you don't plan community, especially the types that have formed in Appalachia over the years. These were organic. They formed over decades, maybe even 100 years in some of the earliest settled places. And even if you could say everybody who lives in this delineated community or this delineated space, we're just going to pick you up and put you down wholesale, which of course would probably be impossible, but even if you could do that, there's still an artificiality to that. And remember, these are people who've just undergone a huge trauma. We don't have a lot of data, obviously, on trauma in Appalachia, but we do have some on other displaced communities, and over again, the loss of agency that comes with experiencing, especially something like a natural disaster trauma, you feel lost, you feel helpless, like you're up against impossible odds. You're dealing with that trauma. That would be bad enough on its own, even if you didn't have to move, but now you've got to put loss of community on top of that trauma. That's not a very good stack to deal with. And especially if you feel like you're being forced or pigeonholed, not by people, but just by circumstance, you know. No one would be like marching these people up the hill, but even that, you might feel forced by circumstance to take whatever is offered and then try to rebuild your life in a situation that you didn't necessarily pick. That loss of agency, that could be problematic.
Filmmaker Mimi Pickering.
Well, maybe it would be possible to try to help a group of families who lived in a particular community to resettle on some of these mountaintops. You know, so if there was a way to keep some of the community together, I think that would be, you know, really healthy and really significant. I don't know that that's possible, but definitely something to keep in mind. And I know a lot of people, you know, have been a lot of survivors have talked about going home. And of course, you know, people are also living on land that's belonged to their families for generation and generation. And that has just a, you know, it's hard to describe what that means for folks.
We know that minds like bodies can be injured by an overwhelming, unimaginable experience, leaving physical conditions that may not be recognized as the symptoms of mental stress.
Despair and shock and maybe some hopelessness.
Depression, increased substance use, anxiety, interpersonal dysfunction.
And as we touched on earlier, there's another condition that makes it difficult to seek help. Applerett attorney Whitney Bailey.
The world in general, for sure, but Eastern Kentucky, 100% don't talk about what they're dealing with because historically they're just, you know, they're told that they are resilient, so they try to live up to that expectation, and it's okay to not be okay. I tell people that very, very often.
That resistance to counseling is also on the mind of Special Projects reporter Chris Begley.
During the Second World War, while London was being bombed, the government there closed museums, concert halls, and other cultural venues. After a month or so of everything being closed, a musician named Myra Hess convinced the authorities to let her perform a concert at the National Gallery. They set up a few dozen chairs. A few thousand people showed up. Those thousands of people risked their lives not just to hear music, but to be with other people, to be part of a community. This reminded them that they were not alone in that awful situation. Back home in Appalachia, we think of ourselves as self-reliant and resilient. We've been told that for so long, since the magazine travel writers of the late 1800s, that it becomes part of our personality, a point of pride. But trying to live up to that image, created by people who want to present Appalachia as different and exotic to try and sell magazines, is exhausting. It takes a toll. Every place has its origin story, a mythical past that we like to think existed but never really did. In the United States, we celebrate rugged individualists, the kind of self-reliant and resilient people that can make do for themselves. 150 years ago, when the country was undergoing a change from rural agrarian society to an urban industrialized one, when the last frontier seemed to be closing, Appalachia was held up as the last example of this pioneer spirit, a place that somehow escaped the problems plaguing the rest of the nation, a place frozen in time. That wasn't true then, and it's not now, but we still struggle with the legacy of thinking of ourselves in that way. We may be self-reliant and resilient, but we can't do this alone. Whether coming out of the recent floods, or dealing with the larger systemic problems that Appalachia, like every place, has had to face, help from the larger community will be part of our way forward. The image we have of ourselves can make it hard to accept help, and even harder to ask for it. For many of us, it's much easier to help somebody else than to recognize that we might need it ourselves. I'm that way, even though I know where these ideas come from. We have something in common with those folks in London in 1940. We want to be part of a community and to know we're not alone and that others share our experiences. Like them, helping others and letting others help, we'll make it through together.
Special Projects reporter Chris Begley. In a moment, keeping it together on the front lines of disaster, stress and trauma among caseworkers and first responders.
When you start thinking, well, I've seen everything, there's something that's going to be thrown at you that you haven't seen, that you're not prepared for.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Episode 4 of RISE, a special series of Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Berea College. With a commitment to serving Appalachian students, Berea has not charged tuition since 1892. All students participate in a paid work program, providing professional experience as well as an inclusive, supportive education. Details at berea.edu.
RISE is a special six-week series airing weekly on Eastern Standard. Learn about what happened when record-setting flash floods hit southeastern Kentucky at the end of July. Explore what contributed to the disaster, how communities are responding, and what's needed to address the challenges ahead. Hear from those most affected and those working on solutions. WEKU's Tom Martin and a team of reporters take us on a journey as Eastern Kentucky navigates a future made less certain by climate change. To learn more about the series and listen to each episode on demand, visit weku-rise.org. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
It's now been 6 months since the flash flood in Eastern Kentucky. Many exhausted survivors still need help getting back on their feet. Coalitions called long-term recovery groups have formed with support from local and national nonprofits to meet this need in flood-impacted eastern Kentucky counties. From WMMT in Whitesburg, reporter Katie Myers.
Every other Thursday at 4:30, a coalition of nonprofit and faith groups meet in a back room at the Pine Mountain Grill in Whitesburg. The group discusses their plan of action for recovery and reports on what they've done so far. They organize donation drives, direct volunteers, coordinate construction projects, and more.
We are assisting one man that's just moved out of the two campers, and he's back home. That's good news, somebody's back home.
That's Kim Miles, a disaster case management supervisor who serves as the recovery group's point of contact for case management. Her work is supported by Community Organized Relief Effort, a national disaster relief group. As a case manager, Miles has talked to dozens of flood survivors.
Like the client that I spoke with today, she's still just dealing with letting things go that she's had to let go.
Miles previously had a career as an elementary school teacher. After the flood, she wanted to help with community recovery, and that led her to leave retirement behind. Her clients are flood survivors, and her work is to offer free support, helping them navigate their emotional and material needs.
Many of our clients that are in campers still, and they don't have transportation, they don't have Wi-Fi most of the time, some don't have phones.
Almost all of Kentucky's flood-impacted counties have their own long-term recovery group. Bailey Richards, the City of Hazards downtown coordinator, is with the Perry County Group.
After a disaster, the community creates their own definition of what long-term recovery is by creating this group, and then that group figures out how to help everybody.
Right now, the purpose of casework is to figure out how to meet everybody's needs. In Breathitt County, they have a little bit of a head start.
Out of the 2021 floods, we created the Breathitt County Long-Term Recovery Team.
Jamie Mullen-Smith works at Kentucky River Community Care as a caseworker and participates in the Breathitt County Recovery Group.
One of the things that we learned in those back-to-back years is you need a backup plan to your backup plan.
This summer was Breathitt County's third major round of flooding in 3 years.
Even though you have things laid out, Mother Nature doesn't work with you.
In particular, Mullen-Smith says there needs to be more planning for managing the aftermath. A plan to address the impact of an entire community experiencing yet another round of massive trauma.
That's going to be a ripple effect for many generations to come. People will probably still be afraid of the rain and that kind of weather when they don't remember why they were, because their families were afraid.
She sees casework as a vital part of long-term recovery planning. Casework is a tiered system. First, seeing that people's material needs are met, which could mean connecting them with appliances or building supplies or food. Then caseworkers see to their clients' emotional needs.
Not everybody is going to recover at the same time, at the same pace. So we have to be working together as a coordinated effort between your local government, your state, your housing alliances, your long-term recovery teams.
Letcher County caseworker Kim Miles is beginning to understand recovery in a new way.
You're seeing people starting to realize that their environment is not at all like it had been, you know, prior to the flood.
Miles said she had only 2 days of training before she went out into the field. She says her caseload is about triple what it should be. Her voice catches as she talks.
I've learned to just go in and focus on really helping one person that day.
Her employer is hiring additional caseworkers, but sometimes it's hard to feel like they can get to everybody. She focuses on doing the best she can, but long-term recovery is hard work, and it's going to take years.
My husband is like, for someone that wasn't flooded, this flood is going to kill you.
For Eastern Standard, I'm Katie Myers, WMMT-FM, in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
If there is any group of people who are at risk of mental stress, it's those who leap into action to help others out of a bad situation and to safety.
First responders are kind of in a special group all of their own.
Eric Heyerholzer, lead public health advisor for the Emergency Mental Health and Traumatic Stress Services Branch of the U.S. Public Health Service.
They have a relatively high level of exposure to the disaster, just in that they are witnessing in the early stages when things are very severe, and they're responding. They're witnessing a lot of damage, potentially injuries, potentially even deaths in the community. And so just being exposed to that on a daily basis can be stressful over time and can cause people to have some burnout and some what we call compassion fatigue and responder stress.
The truth is there's just not enough mental health awareness, I think, among the firefighters.
Stephen Bowling on the phone with Breathitt County reporter Crystal Jones. Bowling wears two hats, one as director of the Breathitt County Public Library, the other as volunteer spokesman for the Jackson Fire Department.
There used to be the old adage, the old tough firefighter just shakes it off and goes on. But there are things that still bother you from time to time. There are things that you see and there are things that you can't explain that I think firefighters carry with them over the years.
What kinds of things?
We had a lot of people who we just could not get to, who were stranded on their rooftops, who were on the hillside that had, you know, they would swim across and get onto the hillside in order to get to dry ground. And for a long period there, It's really frustrating for a rescue or a first responder to know that there are people who need help and we're not able to help them just because of the enormity of the event, just because of our inability to get to them.
Crystal Jones also put in a call to John Allen, now manager of the disaster recovery program at Nesbitt Engineering in Lexington. Allen was, at the time of last summer's flood, emergency management director in Lee County.
Yeah, unfortunately, some folks, when it comes to mental health, look at that as a negative thing, or having to reach for help being a negative thing. And that's a stigma that we have to overcome.
There is a long list of ills that are associated with stress and trauma, but it may not occur to make that connection. Eric Heyerholzer with the U.S. Public Health Service.
In the moment, they may experience things like rapid heart rate or palpitations, muscle tension, headaches, or tremors. They could be feeling fear in a life-threatening situation or a situation that's perceived as dangerous, as well as anger or frustration. Individuals could become disoriented or confused under extreme stress, difficulty problem solving and making decisions. They could become irritable or hostile in social situations, sort of feeling, as if they're somehow to blame or blaming others because of the circumstances. On a less acute level, the kind of stress reactions people have, and this includes first responders, would be difficulty sleeping, either sleeping too much or not being able to sleep, pulling away from people or things that they're typically connected to, having, a low level of energy or no energy, experiencing a variety of aches and pains, somatic complaints, sometimes things that don't necessarily have a physical origin, but may be more related to stress or anxiety, feelings of hopelessness or helplessness, ineffective coping, things like, excessive smoking, drinking, abuse of prescribed medications or other drugs and medications, spending a lot of time worrying or ruminating. And then, in extreme cases, fairly rarely, but it's possible for people to even, think of things like suicide or self-harm or harming somebody else. So there's a variety of things. Again, as I mentioned before, most people don't end up experiencing symptomatology that is diagnosable and severe in nature and do recover over time. And I think that's an important takeaway. It's normal to have stress. It's normal to feel stress. And there's sort of a recovery trajectory, and most people recover over time.
The Department of Health and Human Services maintains a website that is chock full of tips and guides for not only coping with the emotional strain of rescue work, but also information for flood survivors generally. There's a link to it on our site, weku-rise.org. Click on the Resources tab. So, something to know about the way things are in Eastern Kentucky.
Appalachia leans collective in the individualist United States. It's a little bit more collective. It's a pocket. And it's that equality collective, that horizontal collective.
EKU cultural psychology professor Jody Treadway.
So everybody needs to work together, and they're equal, but not an authority or a hierarchy thing. Everyone is reliant in themselves, but you're also part of this group. So at the same time, you have pride in your identity in this group, but at the same time, everybody has to be equal and to put yourself above, either for good reasons, awards, recognition, whatever, or to single yourself out as weaker, victim. You can't. It's like that line from the musical Oklahoma. I don't say I'm no better than anybody else, but I'll be danged if I'm not just as good. The first time I heard that line, it's like, well, that's... Everything has to be equal, everybody on the same footing.
Yes, it can be a challenge for somebody from elsewhere who moves to the region.
Figuring out who to connect with, that's been kind of difficult.
Apple Red's Whitney Bailey.
I'm not from Eastern Kentucky, I'm from Lexington. And I have a huge appreciation and love for this area. But because I don't already have those resources or that network, trying to break into a tight-knit community has been a little bit difficult, but I respect it, and we're working through it.
Dr. Treadway.
to bring an outsider into that balance where everyone's place is understood and things have been more or less the same, and you bring in this outside influence who knows what they might do, who knows what they might think, who knows what they might try to change. You know, our experience with outsiders from various industries and organizations and institutions has not always been pleasant, so that certainly did not help.
But here's another thing about Eastern Kentucky.
The people down here absolutely make up for it because they're so kind and absolutely would give you the shirt off their back if you asked them to, a stranger. It's really cool. I love it.
Earlier, I mentioned something about the kindness of neighbors and strangers. And we've heard what it means to be a member of an Eastern Kentucky community. Governor Beshear.
Now, I've always told people that if you ever think you're going to lose your faith in humanity, just look at how people respond after one of these natural disasters. How good they are. The things they're willing to do and sacrifice for one another, it is truly amazing.
They may drive donations long distances. They come from all around to help muck out homes. Some offer to put up survivors in their own homes or help with hotel rooms. Teresa Botts, the EKU psychologist.
We see the strength in the people in the community and that they give back to each other. There are so many acts of kindness and demonstrations of strong support that have been shown in the media, and people have expressed their thoughts and thanks to each other for just being there. And I think that's one of the strengths that, as Kentuckians, we definitely have carried down generationally.
Documentarian Mimi Pickering found.
It's been kind of amazing to see how concerned and giving people have been. Like they, we've talked to folks who have literally lost their home, and you know they're talking about their concern for their neighbor and making sure that they're okay. And some of the folks from East Kentucky Mutual Aid, you know, we're helping people and giving cash to some people, which was really, really important, really helpful. But they encounter people who maybe, you know, were living in their garage and stuff, but said, no, I don't need it. You know, give it to this family over here. They really need the help more than I do. And that tears your heart up.
Thanks for joining us. Rise in Eastern Standard Series is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage is our executive producer, G. Marie Hibbard, senior producer, Chris Begley, associate producer and special projects reporter, Corinne Boyer, reporter, research support, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. Breathitt County reporter Crystal Jones contributed to this episode. Series partners include the Mountain Eagles' Sam Adams, the reporters of the Daily Yonder, and the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. Rise is online at weku-rise.org, and you can contact us from the site. You can visit the Eastern Standard Archive and other information about the program at esweku.org. And you can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Rise, a production of Eastern Standard on WEKU.